Shabbat shalom. Well, we are into our new year, just coming after Hanukkah. And I don't know about you, but I was exhausted after the week of Hanukkah. Man, I've partied a lot in my life, but that week of last year was amazing. And it was full of just a lot of fun, a lot of fellowship, a lot of food, a lot of parties. And I'm sure you enjoyed it as well. It was interesting. You know, we do our annual children's Hanukkah party every year, and that's a big deal for us. And we're always really overwhelmed with all the kids and all that goes on. It's a lot of work. And Lori Flynn, our children's director, she does such an amazing job every year. She just loves our kids. So during the Hanukkah celebration with the kids, one of our leaders stumbled in the fellowship hall and kind of hit the ground and was back up pretty quick, but I could tell she had really hurt herself. And I'm old enough to know, you know, what it looks like and what it feels like to be hurt, whether it's your back or a knee or something like that. But she really kind of buckled her knee. And I knew right away she was standing against the wall. She had the leg up. She couldn't even put any weight on it. She was just trembling on the verge of tears. And I knew she was really hurt. And I could tell by the way that she kind of fell and, you know, what she did. I thought, man, she's going to be down for a couple days at least, if not a week or two. She's going to be pretty messed up, you know. And right away, there were other members that went over there, and they began to lay hands on her knee and began to pray for her. They sat her down, and they were just praying immediately for her, immediately. And I just zoomed right over there, and I just joined in prayers for her knee. And people are just crying out, God, just, you know, do something, intervene, do a miracle, heal her knee. And they were praying for her, and I looked at her, and I said, scale of 1 to 10, 10 being I need to call 911 and get an ambulance out here. I said, that being 10, you know, where are you at? And she said, I'm at an 8. She goes, it's unbearable, I'm at an 8. And I said, well, let's keep praying. And we did. We kept praying. And after several minutes, I asked her again, I said, where are you at now on a scale of 1 to 10? She says, I'm at about a 6. She goes, I have noticed an actual drop in the pain. And I said, well, let's keep praying. And we did. We kept praying. Got it down to about a 4. It was amazing. You know, I just sensed the presence of God, you know. And the next morning, she texted me early in the morning. She said, Pastor, I want you to know, I'm at a 0. No pain. Going to work today. I told her, I said, that is your miracle for Hanukkah. Hanukkah is filled with signs and wonders. Always has been, always will be. And I thought, wow, that's an amazing thing. God, you're as true and as good today as you've ever been. So what I thought I would do is start the year with a kind of a character profile series for us. And we don't often look at one biblical character and develop that. That's just not my style. It's not what I've emphasized. But I thought, you know, this year, starting, you know, my 26th year in full-time ministry, I want to do something different. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to start to do some profiles of great character. And so I thought I'd start off and lead off this year with Job. Had enough people around me this whole last year trying to get me to talk about Job. And probably, in my estimation, the most depressing book in the Bible. I thought, I don't want to talk about Job. It's so painful. Why would I want to do that? But you know what? The more that I've looked into it, the more I realize the value and the importance of this man's life and the story of his life and what that means to us today. And living in a time that we are currently in where there is such an increasing amount of hopelessness. You know, when you think of the suicide rates, in 10 years, it's tripled among high school age people. Tripled. It's just skyrocketing. And I'm thinking to myself, what is going on in this generation that hopelessness is creeping all the way down into those, you know, younger years? And not only creeping down into those younger years, but spiking at those younger years. What is going on? And, you know, I've come to believe that our departure from God, which I think began in the 60s, is starting to come to fruition. And what is happening is I think that we have young people growing up, and, you know, there's just no meaning to life. And there's so much brokenness in society that has created a hopelessness that they see as their only way out is to end their lives. And it's tragic in every way. And I think that that hopelessness has been climbing for a long time now. Looking at the book of Job, I think we see something that is absolutely amazing. It is a perspective about God that I believe brings hope to everyone who has ever encountered tragedies in their lives. So I think this is going to be a great series for us as we look into his life, and I think that many of us are going to find just an uptick in our hearts of hope, and a hope that's contagious, that can reach out to others around us, both in our families and in our communities, that will actually give other people hope as well as we begin to make our way out of all of the misery that we see around us in our society today. So, Job is a person who is confronted with breathtaking loss and misery. In his quest to find any sanity in it, he hits wall after wall of confusion and senselessness. He's tormented with unanswered questions like, if God is good, why is he allowing this to happen to me? Did I do something wrong to solicit this evil? If God is love, then where is it in our world today? And if God cares at all, then why is he silent? And why is he so far away? Now, Job has some friends that come to him who are the intellectual, I mean, they're the top, brightest, smartest philosophers / theologians of the day. They hear about what's happened to him, and they decide to make a pilgrimage to where he's at to hopefully bring healing to his heart and hope to his soul. But all they do in the end is stir up his agony. Job ultimately reconciles with God at the end of the story. But why? What happened in their relationship? And how did it come back together? And more importantly, what is the meaning of this story? And how does it inform us in our lives today? So I hope to answer some of these questions as we work through this series. I know a lot of us have encountered loss and pain and confusion. At times, we've seen some of our own people walk away. You know, I don't want to name names, but I can tell you that we've had people here who have just been crushed with incredible trials and tribulations, who got discouraged and quit coming. And even though we reached out over and over and over, they just didn't respond. They've just been isolated and have basically said no to their relationship with God. So I hope that we can begin to understand some of these issues, because these issues are all around us and even in our own lives. And I hope to inspire each of us so that we can stay the course and, of course, help others also return to God and be reconciled like Job was. So let's look at chapter 1. We'll work through chapter 1 today as we work on this series and work our way through his story. The stage is set. Let's pick up the reading in chapter 1. This tells us a little bit about Job. There was a man in the land of Uz, not Oz. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. Think about that. Leave that up there for a moment. It says this man was blameless and upright. What does that mean, right? Blameless and upright. Certainly he was a sinner. Certainly he was acquainted with his own shortcomings. So how can a person who is a sinner be called righteous or blameless and upright? The reason that the script tells us this is because in the Hebraic model, in the worldview of the Hebrews, you can be blameless and upright in your brokenness, in your sin. God never said, stop sinning. We were a fallen race by this time, struggling with sin in our natures. God wasn't saying, be perfect and sinless. He was saying, be responsible with your sin. Be responsible with your brokenness. handle and manage your sin on my terms. This is what Job did. He was a broken man, but he was a good man. He revered, he honored God. He was humble, apologetic. He righted the wrongs that he committed from time to time, and he turned from evil. In this sense, he was blameless. In this sense, he was upright, righteous, not perfect, but righteous. Do you know Ezekiel says, of all that have ever lived, three stand out as righteous. Among those three top righteous in his list was this man, Job. Job was considered one of the three most righteous men that ever lived. Job is a good man. He's a great man. He's a man of renown in spite of his brokenness. Verses 2 and 3. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and many, very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the peoples of the East. He was in the top 1% of the 1%ers. Okay? We could say he was a billionaire. If we could put that into today's terms, he was at the top of the top 1%. This is who Job is. Everything is going well with him. He's happy, he's wealthy, and he's healthy. All of this from the hand of the living God. Verse 4. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day. And they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. So on their birthdays, they had just extravagant parties. Keep in mind, too, they had houses. They weren't living in tents because they were wealthy enough to have pretty nice homes. They lived among the 1%ers. And on their birthdays, they would throw these extravagant parties and invite their siblings. You know, it was a family kind of big event that they would throw for one another. Notice what it says in verse 5. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my children have sinned. Catch that? It may be that my children have sinned. Now, if you have children, I know they're not sinners. Other people's children are always the sinners, right? Job says, just in case my children have sinned, right? And cursed God in their hearts, he offered up sacrifices on their behalf. It says, thus Job did continually. This whole idea of sacrifice, of blood atonement in its type and shadow, was already understood early on in human history. And Job, he was a good dad. He loved his kids. He worried about his kids. He made sacrifices on behalf of his kids, saying, God, have mercy on them. If they've sinned against you, have mercy and compassion on them. I offer up to you on their behalf these sacrifices. Have mercy, O God. You know I have 2 daughters. I'll tell you, and anyone that has kids, you just know it, right? You're on your knees quite a bit, saying, God, have mercy on them. Don't take into account their foolishness. You know, watch over them. Spare them from evil. Keep them from the tempter. Job was doing this on a regular basis. He was not like other people who, in their wealth, turned their backs on God and walked away from God. No, he was fully acquainted with the fact that God was the one that made him healthy, wealthy, and prosperous. Satan challenges all of that. Into the picture of the story comes one who is known as the accuser, the adversary, Satan himself. And he comes to challenge God. The challenge is with God. And if we could understand the backdrop of the angelic rebellion and how Satan tried to pull off a coup d'etat and overthrow the king of heaven so that he could reign and rule over creation, we'd have a much better understanding of what's at stake here. I don't have time to develop that, but suffice to say, this is where the stage is set and the crisis begins. Verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan was among them. The sons of God, who are they? These sons of God that came to present themselves before the Lord. And where does the Lord dwell? In heaven. And Satan is there among who? The sons of God. Now, I just want to, I don't have time to develop this either, so this is kind of a side note, but the sons of God are divine beings that are distinct from the angels in terms of their authority, their role, and their function. They are distinct from the angels, a different group. They are divine beings. Let me give you just one verse. Psalm 82. God is speaking here. He says, God has taken his place in the divine council, not in the earthly council, in the divine council. There's a divine council that serves him. That's composed of these divine beings whom God calls his sons. It says, God takes his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. Now, some translations say, in the midst of the rulers, and they try to make the sons of God, the children of Israel, in their leadership. And that's why they use the term rulers or judges. That's not what the Hebrew says. A lot of translations get it right. It actually says God, Elohim, it's the Hebrew word for God, Elohim. It says Elohim takes his place in the divine council, not the earthly council, but the divine council, in the midst of the Elohim. It's not the Hebrew word for judges. It's actually Elohim, the same Hebrew word that's applied to God in the first part of the verse. Elohim takes his place in the divine council in the midst of the Elohim. He holds judgment. This is the divine council in the heavenlies that meet as a council to serve the living God. And Satan is among them, presumably because he also is one of the sons of God. Job 38, 4 through 7. God says to Job, this is way down in the storyline, still part of our side note. We'll get to this part later. But God says to Job, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? So God's talking about the time in which he created the heavens and the earth. Where were you in the beginning, right? When I laid the foundation of the earth. Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? Or what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Timeline. Before we were ever created, long before God created humanity, here are the sons of God shouting for joy, involved in the process of creation itself as a divine counsel to the Most High God. These are ancient divine beings that God himself created, and Satan is among them. Satan. It's not a personal name, by the way. That's not like, you know, the Son of God has a personal name, Yeshua. Satan is not the evil one's personal name. It's actually a title. It's a descriptor. Actually, the translation is the accuser. It's always the accuser. If you were to translate that into English strictly, it would be the Satan. It's always the Satan. It's ha-Satan in the Hebrew. The accuser, the adversary, the antagonist, the one who divides and stirs up trouble. This is who this Son of God became. That's the title given to him. Job 1, 7 through 8. Then the Lord said to Satan, from where have you come? Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Not only did Ezekiel think Job was quite a deal, even God did. God is boasting here. He's saying, hey, have you, in your journeys in the earth, did you stop and consider Job? I mean, this guy was quite the guy, right? Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. I don't know about you, but to have the living God, the creator of all things, seen and unseen, saying things like that about you, that'd be quite a deal. I would love that. Who would not want to hear God talking about us in such manner, right? Verse 9, then Satan answered to the Lord and said, does Job fear God for no reason? Does Job fear God for no reason at all? This is the genius of the evil one. This is the brilliance of this divine Son of God gone bad. Now you think about the implications of what he just said. Oh, Job, yeah, pretty good mensch. But why, God? Do you think Job serves you, fears you, worships you for no reason other than Job's just quite the guy? This is a staggering question that really poses a dilemma that can only be handled one way. Thus, the crisis of Job. Verses 10 through 11. You have put a hedge around him, his house, and all that he has on every side. You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. That's a huge problem, especially presuming that the angelic realm is privy to this dialogue between this Son of God and God himself. Think of the challenge. He's saying, yeah, he's righteous. He's all that you said because you have blessed him, hedged him with blessing, made sure nothing could touch him, and that's why he serves you. You take it away, and we'll see how noble this man is. In other words, your great plan to redeem this fallen race in your image is hopeless because they're not worthy of being saved. They are self-serving. There's nothing righteous in them. Take it away. We'll see. Now, God could answer it a number of different ways, right? He could have said, don't you know who I am? I'm the living God. I know all things, the beginning to the end, and the end from the beginning. You're wrong. And Satan would have said, yeah, prove it. Does God need to prove it? Not really. Unless, of course, all the other beings are there listening as well. Because here's part of the problem with the fall of the angelic realm. They didn't just leave because there was no basis to leave. This enemy, this adversary, was slick. He was brilliant. He posed things that would create doubt, even the divine sons of God. And what was at risk? Well, a huge split in the heavenlies, and also tragedy upon the world that God had created. So in some ways, God was forced into a place to do something that was unthinkable, to allow the enemy to remove the goodness that God had brought to Job. This is the dilemma of the problem of evil in our world. Probably the most positive argument against the idea that there is a God in atheism is the idea that if there is a truly benevolent God who is good, who is loving, then how do you explain all of the evil and heartache in our world. In fact, because there is evil and heartache in our world, there can be no good, benevolent God. That is a powerful, powerful argument against who God is, who he claims to be. And this is what's presented back in the day. And so what does God do? He does what only he can do and has to do. Verse 12, and the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now you think about that. He just handed his son Job over to the evil one with limitations. You can't touch him, but you can touch everything else, including his children. Why? Because God has to defend the integrity of his goodness by allowing something that's going to be perceived as evil. But in the end, it will actually vindicate who he is, and many will come to faith. When he says, Satan, he's in your hand, Job wasn't present. Job doesn't know this. Job's not privy to what's about to take place. Can you imagine the shock that's going to come to Job, who has no idea what's going on, nor will he understand what's going on? Can you imagine the crisis for Job? It will test this hypothesis of the living God, that actually humanity is good and is worth saving in spite of the fall. It's the story of stories. It's amazing in every way. So let's pick up verse 13. Satan attacks Job's possessions and then his children. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And there came a messenger to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them. And the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Can you imagine him going from one servant to the next, not even being able to respond or ask questions, but just simply be informed of the loss of just about everything that he had amassed and was enjoying? And then in verses 18 and 19, the true shock. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, your sons and your daughters were eating. Can you imagine? He's already racing ahead in his mind, thinking, what bad thing happened to them? And while drinking wine in their older brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon them, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you. I'm sure for Job, this completely racked his mind in a way that he could not even begin to understand. The thought that his children, all of them together, dead and gone in an instant, in a moment, the crescendo of the tragedies, the loss of his children. What would you do? What would you think or feel? We can't even begin to imagine the heart of this man and what was going on in his mind at this time. It was as if the world had ended. Here is the first indication that Satan just may be wrong. I'm sure it came somewhat as a surprise even to him. Verse 20. Then Job arose, and he took his robe and tore it. And then he shaved his head, and then he fell to the ground and worshiped. And worshiped. Job is a righteous man. What would we have done in his shoes? You know, what would each of us have done in his circumstances? This is why God boasted in Job. He knew Job. The divine sons of God didn't know him. Satan didn't know him. The onlooking angelic realm didn't know him. This would be, in a sense, a challenge between Satan and God played out in the life of Job. I used to say, I'm glad, you know, I had a teacher tell me early in my ministry, don't worry about Job. That's his story. That's like a one-time story. You know, God would never allow these things, you know, to us, especially under the new covenant where there's grace upon grace. But it's an important story, so, you know, pay attention to it. I'm so relieved. I thought, yeah, I'd never want anything like that. Well, I grew up, and I matured. You know what I discovered? The story's written because these stories play out over and over and over in the lives of believers. And that's why the story's written, so that when it does come to us, we too can pass the tests. Verse 21, and he said, naked I came from my mother's womb. Think of the perspective. Naked I came from my mother's womb. In other words, I came with nothing. Naked shall I return. In other words, all the earthly possessions that we have are temporary. Don't invest everything into those, especially your identity. You came with nothing, you're going to leave with nothing. So keep that material possession stuff in its proper perspective. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Is that true? Or did Satan take it away? Did the Lord or Satan take it away? See, everyone wants to say, well, Satan took it away. I've heard theologians work this thing in such a way that it's Job's fear that brings it, and that God was hoping that Job wouldn't even fear, therefore Satan wouldn't even have gotten a way into his life. And I'm thinking, what? Why are you so afraid of the sovereignty of God? Are you trying to be the caretaker of his character and reputation, as if God would never allow something like that? And if he did, then he's not good? The Lord is the one that gave the permission to Satan to remove everything. Therefore, the Lord is responsible for the removal of it. And Job understood that. And he said, blessed is the Lord. He gives and he takes away. Blessed be his name. Verse 22, in all of this, Job did not sin, nor charge God with wrong. People, that's the last verse in this chapter. Did Job pass the test? Absolutely. The design of the enemy is to use pain, anguish, confusion, and to get you to come to that place where you believe God did this to you. And then to get you to curse God for what has happened. That's his whole plan. Get you to blame God and curse God for whatever's happened. Job, he said, nope. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. I'm going to worship him. Regardless, I am his. Job passes the test. I would like to say that's the end of the story. that Satan was put in his place, and Job was vindicated, as well as God's good name. But it's not. The worst is yet to come. It gets crazy. It goes so deep as to wonder how anyone could ever, ever persevere in their faith under the circumstances. But this is the story of Job. Does he get angry at God? Yeah. Does he speak out and shout at God? Yes. Like Jacob, he wrestles with God, demands things from God. In this drama that we're going to encounter, we'll be shocked with his behavior, but yet God allows that behavior and does not consider it sin. God's big enough for the dialogue. God's big enough for our fears, our shame, our questions, because he is good and he's actually there for us. So in conclusion, in application, I just want to say that trials and tribulations come to every child of God in this life without exception. If they haven't come to yours, just hold on. They're coming. Don't get excited. They'll come. The purpose and the meaning is not always clear. You're not always going to make sense out of the things that happen to you or come to you. If the Lord gives blessings, then he can also take away the blessings. And in doing so, still remain good, because he is good. You see, true faith is trusting that God is good even when your circumstances cry out differently. And here's some of the questions. Has your faith ever been tested by the fire of adversity and tragedy? Has God ever seemed distant in your life? Have you ever felt like he's abandoned you? Is he consistently quiet, refusing to answer you or speak to you in the midst of your tragedy? Have you ever felt like giving up and just walking away from all of it? This is the test of faith. And Job passes that test, at least initially. And God says, in all that has happened, Job has not sinned. But can he maintain that? And for how long? And what else is coming to him? Or to you, right? Every one of God's children will experience the principles that we find in the story of Job. And here's the big one. Your faith will be tested. You can bank on that. Why? Because this is how faith is refined and matured. It grows only in the soil of tragedy and hardship. Faith only comes to life and takes form in the midst of crisis. It is purified by fire. No one is exempt, because God is love and he loves you and he wants to raise you up in your faith. Therefore, he allows the trials and the tribulations to come to us. The story of Job is designed to preserve our faith, to encourage us to stay the course, to help us to pass the testings of our faith. And why? Again, because God is good. And he will bring you into that reality if you trust in him in spite of the insanity of your trials and tribulations. I'll leave you with this passage in closing. This sums up everything about God. This is how God was vindicated in the end. Romans 8, verse 28. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. Every hardship, every trial, everything that's ever happened to you that's evil or bad or whatever you want to call it, if you trust in God, like Job, if you persevere, if you hold on, and he'll give you the grace to hold on, In the end, he's going to turn it around for your good. Why? Because he's going to prove to you, to the angelic realm, to the divine council, and especially to Satan, that he is good, and so are those whom he has redeemed. Amen? Are we ready? Because the worst is yet to come. Next week, when we pick up the story of Job. But be encouraged. Hold on to God. He is worth trusting in. Shabbat shalom.
And Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, may Yahweh bless you and keep you. May Yahweh make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace." And we add, "In the name of Yeshua, our Messiah, the Prince of Peace, so they shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them. Receive now the name of Yahweh." Yivarechecha Yahweh ve'yishmerecha Yaher Yahweh panav alecha ve'yihunecha Yisrael Yahweh panav alecha vayasem lecha shalom. B'shem Yeshua HaMashiach, Sar HaShalom, Shabbat Shalom.